The Lord be with you. That's better. When I was younger, quite a bit younger, I ran with the crew, and we were living on the edge. We lived some pretty intense times together. We were in the same Sunday school class. I'll have you know, I collected the award for perfect attendance a couple years in a row. It's a pretty big deal, I know. Bible memorization was a really big thing with us. But the thing that made our crew really stand out is that we put a huge value on the memorization of the 66 books of the Protestant canon. We would exchange glances when other people had to use the index at the beginning of the Bible to find their books. We were very competitive during sword drills. Anyone here do sword drills back in the day? That's right. The classic sword drill joke, Hezekiah 6. Nobody got burned with the Hezekiah joke? There's no book of Hezekiah, so everyone's frantically searching, but okay. It was a very small and isolated community I grew up in, I guess. Knowing the names of all these books in order seemed like a pretty big deal. And it seemed like such an important part of a lifetime of study in this thing called the Bible. But when I look back on that, that practice seems kind of strange to me, even harmful in its own way. Someone rattling off the names of all these ancient writings, it's pretty great if you need to find a verse real quick. It's handy, I guess. But I could also say that this practice had the effect of flattening out, skimming over, ironing out what is really a complex and diverse assortment of writings, of poetry, history, readings. So we'd start chanting it out, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Yeah. Moving right along. Deuteronomy. Too many syllables, and really not a very fun read, is it, if you've read it? Seems like a repeat of other assorted laws, pronouncements we've seen in those other books, and includes capital punishment for children. Shocking policies for how to deal with sexual assault. It's got an uncomfortable, and I mean uncomfortable, bent towards genocide and mass murder. You can't really blame the average Sunday school teacher if they want to just skim past it. Can't really blame you if you're thinking, great, sermon about Deuteronomy. Maybe we should flatten out and skim over Deuteronomy. And it's not only Sunday school curriculum that does this. Our lectionary did this. Just last week, we were in the book of Exodus. We've leapt past the book of Numbers, skipping it all together, right to the end of the book of Deuteronomy. The thing is, no one even told me why our English Bible uses a Greek name for a Hebrew book. Nobody explained any of those strange laws and nationalist decrees to me. Truth is, I can't answer all of those questions for you today, but we'll start with Deuteronomy, Greek meaning second law. That's what it was named in the Septuagint. It's the Greek Bible that would have been around about the time of Jesus. This book does give us a glimpse of a growing understanding of God revealed in the world. The book of Deuteronomy was the work, a collaborative work of a people who were doing their best with their limited knowledge to understand a living God. It was a great work in process. They were making sense of God's faithfulness. They were renaming, reshaping the terms of the covenant in light of a lot of troubling and messy relationships. Relationships with the land, with their neighbors, with their God, and there's lots of talk about idolatry. Always with the idolatry. Maybe you've heard the old quip, tragedy plus time equals comedy. Well, by that measure, Deuteronomy should have been a very funny book. See, it was written at a much later date. I think around 650 BC. And maybe you remember the story of Josiah. And Deuteronomy gives us a perspective on a chapter in Israel's history after they'd known a lot of tragedy and a lot of horrors, and they've witnessed the troubling passage of so many unsettling years. They've suffered under conquering armies, national divisions, their share of corrupt leaders. This was a people who'd known times of want and need. Deuteronomy was a reacquaintance with faithfulness, a rereading of the law, with fresh eyes on old stories. This was a people ready for a new start. You could call it a reformation, even. Deuteronomy, this second law, was the word of the Lord re-presented to the people. A fresh beginning, a reboot, a renewal of the vows, with faithful leaders, and hopefully a new era of righteousness and prosperity. Wouldn't that be great? And a critical piece of this whole movement was the handoff of power. And when I say handoff of power, I mean the big handoff of power. Our passage today marks the end of Moses' life, of his ministry, and of his strange and mysterious death for an extraordinary man. This is the big finale in a long journey of miracle and revelation that starts with that story about a baby hidden in the bulrushes. And then a life filled with miracles and wonders. And finally here at the end of Deuteronomy, God's friend breathing his last breaths on Mount Nebo. Each moment of Moses' life has been in God's hands, and the results have been nothing short of spectacular. There's a reason Moses is called the unequaled prophet. The text even tells us here, never since has there arisen a prophet in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. What would Judaism be without Moses? What would global history look like without Moses? The Exodus of a captive nation, the lawgiver of Israel, the prophet without equal, the leader of his people. Who would ever want to follow that act? Who could measure up to a man like Moses? And so, 120-year-old Moses sits atop the mountain and looks over the horizon. And the text winks at us a little and reminds us that Moses actually still had good eyes and still had some vigor left in him. Well, this is the end of the line. God is calling it quits for Moses. With a secret gravestone, a private ceremony, there's no shrine or place to visit. And from that mountaintop, God lets Moses see the land from a distance, the land promised to his people. And owing to some previous unpleasantness with a fit of rage and a rock, this is the land that Moses would never know. Moses would die just a few kilometers short of the promised land. The Lord said, "This is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants." And so the children of Israel mourned their leader for 30 days. But reality has a way of creeping up on us, and people need a leader. And so, for the big handoff, we're told that Joshua, son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom because Moses had laid hands on him. This other guy, this totally not Moses guy, is going to lead the people now. And the death of Moses turns out to be the commissioning of Joshua, as the reins of power are handed from one leader to the next. Like I said before, Deuteronomy was compiled so that people could reacquaint themselves with the law of the covenant. They were reminded of God's promises. They were reminded that God's promises could be carried from generation to generation. Moses was not the key to this whole enterprise. Joshua could take the reins of power and lead God's people. And when he had met his end, when he was laid to rest in the earth, the work could continue with someone else. How important a lesson is this? Well, how many isms can you think of right now? How many denominations, how many movements have a name attached to them? The name of some long-dead person. Human beings, that includes us, are generally speaking not long-term thinkers. Too often we are kind of sheeple, looking for a leader who will give us all the answers. We tend to get bogged down in that one leader's master plans. We get myopic fairly quickly. Quite often, actually regularly, we need to be reminded of the bigger picture that is at work here. Another lesson for people who've known a long and troubled history, a horrific history at times even, it goes like this. The promised land is not a happily ever after kind of deal. It's one thing to look forward to the big day, the day the people would enter the promised land. That's our story next week, actually. Promising yourself that when you hit the big time, when you're out of a few jams, your troubles will be over. That being said, it's quite another thing to sit in the remains of a broken kingdom, pulling together the remnant of a people, remembering a long list of mistakes and regrets and failures, and still call that place the promised land. Again, it's only human to look forward to the next big thing. We do this in our daily lives. We do this in our life of faith. Don't we all dream of a better tomorrow? Aren't there a long list of troubles we'd like to see made right? Troubles in our communities, troubles in this world, troubles in our lives. But no matter how many of those we check off the list, we're never exempt from the hazards of life, and wherever we go, we will always bring ourselves and our follies and our failings and our fears with us. This year, the church looks back on 500 years of Reformation. And what a 500 years it's been. With the vantage point of history, we can look back on some really great moments. Stuff we could be proud of. But we can also look back on some truly horrible embarrassments. Now and then we've followed some really big names, and we've buried every one of those men and women, trusting that the continued work of God in the world relies on the goodness of our Maker from generation to generation. We have so much to be grateful for, and yet we have an abundance of challenges and struggles. The work of the church is ongoing. It's frustrating. It's difficult. It's strange. It's beautiful. And we get to be a part of it in the year 2017, and maybe even 2018. I guess we'll see. This morning we read Psalm 90, a psalm of wisdom and reflection. And as it happens, a psalm attributed to Moses. It opens with, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Now, we didn't get to pick which generation we were born into. And we don't know how many days any of us gets on this earth. And it really is frustrating sometimes to live as such frail and vulnerable and little creatures with such fragile bodies in such a short span of time. In geological time, we really are like grass clippings. And the crazy part is that our Creator is super okay with populating a world with human beings made of common minerals and water. We live as tiny little specks in a vast universe, and we breathe this gossamer thin atmosphere on a little rock in space. God is super okay with that. Our time, at best, is short. But we have a voice now in this place. We have our own frame of reference, our own story. We have our work cut out for us. We have this church as it is now, in this place, in this generation, for this time, in this place, and this people. And when we've joined our ancestors in the earth, we will hand on the work to another gathering of God's children. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Today's scripture reading carries its own historical weight for another reason. Because this Deuteronomy passage was the last reference in the famous "I've been to the mountaintop" sermon, which happened to be the final sermon ever preached by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He preached it the day before he was gunned down in Memphis, Tennessee. It was 49 years ago this year. It's about two generations. I actually can't imagine what Dr. King would think if he watched the news today. How broken his heart would be. But he is at rest now. This is not his time. This is our time. And here's the thing. The world needs voices like Dr. King's. Voices that call for justice. The world still needs a church made of people who love mercy. We are called to create a place of radical welcome, hospitality, peace, and reconciliation. And this is hard work. Sometimes it's dangerous work, and none of us know how this is all going to play out. But we do need to keep asking ourselves, in light of God's abiding love for us, what will we do with these days that we've been given?